Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for the 29th of January 2014. And joining me for this edition, assistant editor Steve Withers.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Games editor Mark Botwright.
I used to be in a barbershop quartet in Skokie, Illinois.
News editor Mark Hodgkinson.
I just can't believe we're going to walk into certain death.
And audio reviewer Ed Selly.
I'm the guy that's going to get you. I just wanted you to know that.
And kicking off, Phil's intro could make some gag about us being the usual suspects. No, I'm not going to go there. Welcome to the AV Forums weekly podcast. Let's get straight into things. As I say, straight away, we've had a lot of talk in the last two podcasts about 4K. So let's go to the technical side of things. Mark, news about a new encoding process, which offers a chance at 12-bit colour. Explain this a little bit.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's not just 4K either. It's compatible with full HD as well. So it's a company, a specialist company called Folded Space, who are claiming they have come up with some algorithms, both on the encoding and decoding side, that will restore the full bit depth, full colour bit depth, rather, for your Blu-ray content, whether that's 4K or full HD. So it'll rely on an encoder being present in either the player or the display. And on the face of it, it sounds like it could be excellent. So the reason that's a good thing, it gives effectively an 8-bit colour, which is the current Blu-ray and DVD standard, gives you 256 shades, for want of a better word, per colour. 12-bit colour gives you 4,096 effective shades of a colour. So your increased dynamic range would be the major benefit. And they can claim it can all be done with very little data overhead. So as regards delivery, either broadcast, streamed, or on disc, they think it's really doable. Problem I see with it is getting the support of the industry. So they're offering it for the software providers, i.e. the movie and TV program content providers, as a free encoding tool. And they'll expect a small license fee from the hardware manufacturers. So they need to get it in at both ends. And get people to
trust Steve to go that way. I think the important thing here, Mark, is that DVD and Blu-ray, it's 8-bit. That is a specification. We're not talking about changing that.
No, it's kind of a colour upscaling trick by the sounds of it. So no, they're not talking about changing that. They say it's a simple implementation at either end that will have, you know, greater benefits to picture than pure resolution will, which, you know, we can see the point of that.
Well, there's a lot of companies at the minute, especially display companies, which add 12-bit processing into their video processing side of things to try and cut down on banding and obvious gradation and that kind of thing and colour changes. So what makes this different?
What makes it different? I don't know. Well, it does make it different. I guess it's at both ends of the chain. I guess that's the real key. So it's at the encoding side and the decoding side, whereas where it's just in the display or the video processor, it's just display side only. So I guess they will be able to restore more accurate information if they know what's being encoded. So I guess that's the real benefit. It's a two-sided solution. I'd like to see it in action, but I have doubts of whether the industry will really pick up on it.
And was there any inclination as to when this would be available?
From now, I think. I think it's available now.
So, Mark, you wrote an article which went up on the site last week about codecs for use with 4K. Tell us about it.
Yeah, just before CES kicked off, YouTube came out to say that they got a lot of content support for their own compression codec, which is VP9. It's a successor to VP8, surprisingly, which didn't do too well for them. They got very little in the hardware support. The industry didn't really like it because they thought they copied MPEG-4, H.264. But they came out and announced they had, I think it was 19 content partners, including the likes of Samsung, Panasonic, Sony, but also chipset manufacturers. So, it was with the aim to deliver streamed content from the internet for their 4K apps for the various display manufacturers. Basically, it's twice as efficient as VP8, allowing streaming of 4K at relatively low bitrate. But prior to that, no one had really seen that coming. Everyone thought we've also got to say, as we discussed last week, 4K Blu-ray is happening, according to the BDA, by the end of the year. And one of the stumbling blocks is which compression codec they will use on disc. Everyone thought it was nailed on that it was going to be HEVC, H.265. But the emergence of VP9 and the hardware support they've got means that the VP9 is actually a candidate for 4K Blu-ray. So it's then a question of, encoding support. Again, we're talking about encoding, with what the content partners will prefer. Now, in terms of VP9, it's open source, so there's no license fee. That won't be the case with H.265, although they have relaxed it for content makers. So previously with H.264, when a certain amount of content was sold by, say, the likes of Netflix, e.g., they would have to pay a license fee up to the maximum, I think it's $20 million or something. So quite considerable sums. So they've dropped it that on that side, but for hardware decoders, the manufacturers will be paying license fees, but VP9 will be free. So that it's got that advantage. In terms of technical merits of each, it's a bit tricky at the minute. There's not a lot out there encoded by either that we can actually get to see. In theory, they're roughly similar in performance, but they approach the problem in a slightly different way. Basically, they take big blocks of pixels, compress it very quickly, and then it's decompressed at the other end to restore the details. Now, with HEVC, it can do 64 by 64 blocks, whereas H.264 was 16 by 16. So that's, in theory, that's what, four times more efficient. And VP9 acts in a very similar way. The only major difference is, well, there's two major differences, actually. VP9 can do it in rectangular shapes, which in theory will make it more efficient for those doing the encoding. So they can, just as an example, if you had a scene with where you had a close-up of a face and lots of sky in the background, they would pay more attention to the face, get more details out on the face, and use larger blocks for the sky. Whereas with the rectangular shape sort of versatility, they can perhaps be a bit more efficient with VP9, but the reinterpretation of HEVC is quite a little bit more advanced than VP9 on paper. So it's VP9 extrapolates in 9 different directions as compared to 30 odd for HEVC. So I tend to think that the industry will come out of on the side of H.265, just from familiarity of tools from H.264, yeah, and a general trust. But, VP9, I guess they could include both. I mean, in theory, because VC1 is one of the standards for Blu-ray. Yeah. I mean, it's not widely used, but it's there. So they could approve both at the end of the day.
Yeah, cool. So it's certainly moving along. Be interesting to see which one they actually go with, or if they go with both. And it'd be nice to see some content to actually assess how well these codecs work.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's just stick with 4K for a second. Announcement from Samsung today, Mark, from their forum in Marbella, that they are releasing their 4K video player.
Yeah, announced at CES, only confirmed for the USA at that point, was they've reached some... The whole thing around CES was the ecosystem, the expansion of their 4K ecosystem. So they had a YouTube app, Netflix app, blah, blah, blah. But they also had this little hard drive player that they announced would come to the USA. But it's been confirmed for Europe and the UK. So they've got agreements, I know, with Fox and Paramount. So there'll be 50 titles, mostly movies, but some documentaries, I believe, that will be downloadable and playable through this little device.
Yeah, now, I think it comes with 8 preloaded, Mark.
Is it 8,
and then they release a number each quarter until after a year it will be 50 in total.
Yeah, but it's good. I mean, it's good. At least they're doing it as opposed to a certain other manufacturer, beginning with S.
Yes.
The questions remain whether it'll work with other TVs. I doubt it. I think it'll just plug into the One Kinect box. There's going to be certain exclusivities around it, exclusivities of content, as we saw around sort of Blu-ray launch as well, tied to manufacturers. But at least there'll be something to watch for Samsung owners.
Yeah, well, you got to hope that that's going to kick Sony's butt to move and release the player in the UK.
Quite reasonably priced as well, I thought. I mean, it was only announced in euros, but €299, so we probably expect £279 or something like that. Not a bad price.
£299. The same with dollars. Everything just transfers on a one-to-one relationship with electronics in the UK, regrettably.
This is true. But I still don't think it's a bad price for a first generation 4K player.
The worrying precedent, though, is you've got Samsung locking in some content for their TVs with Paramount and Fox. You've got Sony, obviously, locking in content for their TVs. Yeah. If they do it in the UK, they are doing it in the States, at least, with their own media player for obviously Sony content for Columbia Pictures. If you start seeing other manufacturers doing that, you end up in a situation we were in with the beginning of 3D Blu-ray, where you had, like the biggest film of all time locked in with people who bought Panasonic TVs. And that's just a way of killing something, I think.
Sorry, maybe they're thinking this early on and it doesn't really matter so much as getting a sort of a head start over their fellow manufacturers.
Well, I mean, you can just see Samsung saying, buy one of our 4K TVs, we'll give you this player with 8 movies on and you can download stuff. People are more likely to buy that than a Sony. Yeah, I'm more likely to buy that than a overpriced Panasonic, because you're getting content and that's what people want. And let's face it, Netflix might be going 4K, but how many of these deals that people are on where they're going to run into fair usage throttling, trying to download 4K movies from Netflix, it's going to be a big issue. So at least if it's on a hard disk, you can play it and you're going to be able to watch it.
Yeah, and you can download it at your leisure, I guess, Yeah, you don't have to be. You can be careful. You can keep monitor what you're downloading, I guess. So, yeah, probably a better answer for a lot than Netflix.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing. I'm all for it, particularly someone who can get nowhere near 15 megabytes a second. My concern just is if it starts becoming, exclusive deals locking up specific studios, that could be dangerous.
Let's move on. Let's talk about some actual hardware. Steve, you got the JVC X500 in for review. We've been waiting for this since November. Finally arrived. What's your thoughts?
We have, Phil. We have been waiting some time for this. Quite why it's taken so long, I'm not really sure. According to JVC, they've been selling stock. They haven't had any available to actually send out for review. But the first one's arrived. Riven? First one's arrived. The X500, which is, I guess, the middle. I mean, they've still got the X35 from last year, which is going to be the entry-level projector. Then we've got the 500, then the 700, which is TXX certified and sort of sits in the same price bracket as the Sony VW500. And then there's also the X900, which will be the sort of the limited edition, very high-end one, which should be about, 10 grand. So 500 retails, I think, for about 5,200. So a little bit more than last year. I think last year the X55 was 499. There have been some changes made. They've ported across some of the features that are actually on last year's X75. So it's got a few more features than it did previously. Still got a CMS, which is good news. It's got eShift, was it eShift 3 now? The latest version of eShift. Interestingly, and I think this is something you were talking about with me, Phil, last year there were a number of different settings for eShift. There was film, which was the one that we always recommended you used, and there's some other ones like HD and things like that, which were used a lot more sharpening. It gave a much more processed, artificial look to the image, whereas film was quite natural and gave it a nice film-like quality. This year, there's only one setting. You can adjust the amount of effect that the setting has, but there's just the one setting. Now, I've watched a couple of films on it so far, and it looks to me as if that one setting is the film setting. It doesn't seem to be adding any unnecessary sharpening or excessive processing. It doesn't make it look unnatural, and the motion doesn't appear overly smooth. So to my eyes, at least so far, it appears to be the film setting with a bit of control in terms of how much of that effect you can have. They've also changed some of the menu systems, changed a few things here and there. Now, like a lot of people, I'm not a big fan of change. Initially, it was a little confusing because I'm quite used to the JVC menu system. It's been the same for the last few years. And so for the first half an hour, I was thinking, well, where's that and what's this? But once I got used to it, set it all up properly, put on a movie, I put on a bit of Pacific Rim. And I have to say the picture was absolutely stunning. JVC projectors, you can debate the benefits or non-benefits of the fact that it's not a native 4K panel. But in terms of pure picture quality from a Blu-ray, which is what you're going to be watching for the next 2 or 3 years, a standard 1080p Blu-rays, the amount of 4K content you're going to have access to, quality 4K content is going to be limited. So, and it can accept 4K, although obviously it'll then be down-resing and up-resing afterwards. But just with a put on a Blu-ray, the picture was absolutely stunning. It was a beautiful image, very film-like, lovely blacks. You know, looked accurate. I haven't actually calibrated it yet, but it certainly appeared quite accurate out of the box. I hadn't seen a JVC projector other than my own, if not a review sample since the X55, which was a year ago. So it was really impressive. I was genuinely impressed with the image. And it was a refreshing reminder just how good a JVC can look. And, you know, I know there's been a lot of debate since they announced these models. You know, oh, they're not native 4K. And that's true, they aren't. And if you want native 4K and you want future-proofing, you've only really got one choice at the moment, and that's Sony. But if you're being realistic about this and thinking, well, how much 4K content is there going to be going forward? And what you're going to mostly be watching is 1080p and probably Blu-rays, then the picture on the X55 and hopefully, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but the X500, and hopefully when we see it, the X700 was absolutely stellar, and I was very impressed with it.
I mean, the obvious question is going to be, is the Sony worth $2,500 more for the native 4K?
Against the X500?
Yep.
Yeah. I guess the only reason you would do that is if you want to be future-proof. If you think, I think, you know, we're going to go into a 4K world, and maybe you think that we're going to go into a 4K world a lot quicker than it currently looks like we are, then maybe you can make an argument saying, I want 4K. And if that's the argument you're using, then yes, you can justify the extra cost of the Sony.
Well, I'm going to stop you there, because where are you going to get your 4K content?
Well, no,
because
I was just about to say, there's going to be any 4K content for quite a while. I don't think 4K Blu-ray is going to be a viable option for another year and a half. Okay, so that's 18 months before you can actually watch Blu-ray. Netflix 4K, I don't think, based upon what I saw at CES, will stand up to big screen projection.
Well, you can't get it for a start, because it's only going to be available on 4K TVs. So
that's true. Yes, you need the app, don't you? Yeah, you're right. Good point. So on that basis, unless Sony launch their 4K player, your access to 4K content is very, very limited and is going to remain that way for the foreseeable future. So on that basis, and all you're going to be doing is watching up-res Blu-ray, then you're down to pure picture quality. Now, the picture on the VW500 was very good. Don't get me wrong. It was a superb picture. But the 500 was equally as good. Had the edge in terms of black levels, obviously. It's a JVC. And the 3D was superior on the JVC. Now, having said that, I've heard a lot of varying comments. I mean, the VW500 that I had in for review had dodgy 3D. The 3D was definitely, there was something wrong with it. Now, I've heard other people that I trust who have had VW500s and have said, you know, the 3D was great. So it's possible that I just had a duff unit. Having said that, same people that had the good 3D have also commented on bad, you know, bad panel alignment, problem focusing the VW500. It seems to me as if there could be a bit of a quality control issue with some of these projectors, which is worth bearing in mind if you're spending 8,000 quid. So all in all, you know, the 500 at 5,000 quid, that's a good buy. I mean, you're getting an awful lot of projector and an awful lot of performance for that kind of money. You know, it's not spare change. Don't get me wrong. £5,000 is a lot of money to play for a projector. But, you know, for what you're getting for that money, it is definitely worth considering, particularly if the 700 or the VW500 are just a little bit out of your price range. I mean, the extra $2,000-$3,000 is a lot of money. I mean, it's, you know, if you can't go that far, but you can get to 500, then 5,000, sorry, then the WX500 is definitely worth considering.
A lot of fives for you to remember there. You're forgiven.
Oh, these bloody model numbers are driving me nuts.
I guess the enthusiast question then, Steve, and you can answer this because you've seen both projectors. So you've got the X500, which is going to up-res your Blu-ray to pseudo 4K using eChef 3 versus Blu-ray upscaled to a native 4K panel, which is best?
Okay, and this is from memory, obviously, but I preferred the upscaled image on the VW500, the Sony, in terms of its sort of the because it had a 4K panel to play with that gave it a lot, you know, and it was scaling up, but it had more room to play with in terms of upscaling the 1080p to the 4K panel. Having said that, I prefer the overall look of the X500, the JVC, because the native blacks and the just had a more, and I know it's the film we discussed before, but it had a more analog film-like image quality to it. The Sony was very sharp and very detailed, but perhaps a little bit too sharp and detailed sometimes, a little bit too pristine for its own good. So I think on balance, I'd probably go for the JVC.
Okay. Glad you got your words out in the end. And let's move on quickly. HD91, we mentioned it last week. You've had a bit more time with it now. Writing up the review, what's your final assessment of that one?
I was genuinely very impressed with this one. I've got to say, I think Optoma have absolutely pulled Rabbit out of the hat in terms of delivering a home theatre LED projector for £2,999. It's, you know, that's quite impressive when you consider that the other two that I've reviewed so far have been £15,000. It's a big difference in price, but it isn't like a huge drop in performance. You know, they've used a decent sized lens, so a single chip DLP, nice sharp image, plenty of brightness, 1,000 lumens. I mean, the same as the other two projectors that I reviewed. I mean, that's about as bright as you can get with an LED light source, but certainly more than bright enough in my admittedly completely blacked out room. But you know, I didn't feel as if it was struggling to light up what is, I've got a very large screen. You know, it wasn't struggling to light it up. Image quality was really accurate, and it had a full CMS, so you could get a really nice, accurate image. The 3D was absolutely spectacular. Always is with DLP. DLP is particularly effective with 3D. And again, it had the brightness to handle it. It didn't seem dim in 3D at all. And there was absolutely no crosstalk. Motion handling was superb. The only area really where I can criticize this projector, and this is really true of all DLP projectors, is the black levels were fairly mediocre. You lost a bit of detail in the shadows. Shadow detailing, you know, left a bit to be desired. Black levels were quite poor. But to be honest, I've seen £30,000 DLP projectors that have struggled in terms of black levels and shadow detail. So that's not really a criticism of a £2,999 projector. What is important to remember is if you're interested in LED as an alternative light source, it's not going to dim over time. It's got, you know, 10, 20,000 hours of life in them, if not more sometimes. You haven't got to change the bulb. You've got consistency with the image. You've got instant on and off. There's lots of real advantages here. I was really genuinely impressed with what Optoma have managed to pull off here in terms of delivering an LED projector to the mass market.
Excellent. So that wraps up hardware. We'll be back in a second with games news. So kicking off games, kinda. Neil Blomkamp is possibly going to direct a Halo TV pilot. This seems interesting, Mark.
Yes, the District 9 director, and of course Elysium as well. It's a rumor at the moment. So it's the rumor is that because of course he's got a long-standing interest with it, because he was set to helm the scrapped Halo movie. He's still kind of, you know, occasionally talks about it, and he obviously it's something that he'd like to do. And he's produced some live action Halo shorts, which are kicking about on the internet still. So, you know, it's obviously something that he holds an interest in, and fingers crossed it turns out to be true, because the shorts certainly were, you know, quite accomplished for, you know, fairly low budget little kind of experiments. And this again is Microsoft trying to give exclusive premium content for, you know, people to get behind their paywall.
So this is going to be behind the paywall, then? This is going to be something that you're going to have to pay to watch?
Yeah, it'll have to be. Again, it comes under that banner of premium content, and they've kind of been scrabbling around to try and justify that. And I think, you know, Halo TV series, it kind of ticks the boxes. I'll be very interested to see how it comes across, because I'm still of the opinion that, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why the film didn't come out was, it's very hard to translate something that's got kind of fantastical elements and different creatures unless you're going to throw a huge amount of money at it or not show the creatures very much.
Yeah, because, you know, didn't they already do a TV movie for Halo? It was a bit ropey. Forward onto Dawn, yeah, that was it.
Yeah, there's lots of bits and bobs as well where people have kind of taken stuff from that and pasted it into their own little edits, which sometimes turns out actually better than the originals. The general
rule.
Trust me,
I watched 25 minutes of it. That wouldn't be hard.
No. Well, the problem is that you've got two choices. You either, number one, show a lot of what, you know, the universe is, in which case you've got to throw a lot of money at it. Or number two, you know, if you look at the produced shorts that Neil Blomkamp did, it was very kind of green grass, you know, shaky cam, if in doubt, cut quickly. And that's pretty much the only way that it can work, I think. So, yeah, it'll be very interesting to see exactly how they handle that, because the worst thing they could do is produce something kind of half-assed that almost damages the idea of premium content altogether.
The Xbox launch, was Steve Spielberg not attached to this?
Yeah, he is. It's going to be him. I think he's executive producer, yeah. Though. So it's one of those, you know, chuck a name in there and that'll do. I'd be very surprised if he was, you know, terribly hands-on with this.
If it is Neil Blomkamp, I'd be interested to see what he does, because it seems to me as he's used a lot of stuff and ideas that maybe was developed for the Halo movie in his other films. I mean, the prawns and the technology and the weapons in District 9 were very Halo-esque. Elysium itself, the space station, is right out of Halo. Some of the spaceships in Elysium, a lot of the technology in Elysium, again, some of the firearms in Elysium, body armor and the robo suits, all right out of Halo. It seems to me as if he's been plundering the unfilmed Halo movie for ideas for his own movies already to date.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got the track record there for using the same kind of imagery. So that kind of sounds a little bit promising, but I just hope that, you know, the one thing that the things like the shorts always show up, which is as soon as you shoot something low budget and you're not using the proper film stock, if you're shooting it just on video, it just looks poor. It just looks like a little student film or something. No matter how much you cut it, no matter how shaky you make the camera, you can never quite get away from that. So, you know, I think District 9 is perhaps the best sign that he can kind of hopefully marry the two, live action and a little bit of CG, or perhaps just men in suits.
On a very limited budget as well, and District 9.
And that was filmed on video.
Mm. Yeah, that's a fair point.
So let's move on from Halo. Gears of War franchise, Microsoft acquiring the rights to that.
Yes, obviously it's been a Microsoft exclusive thus far, but they've bought the rights to the intellectual property from Epic outright, so not just obviously the future, but for all the existing games as well, just in case they turned up on other, you know, game services on rival platforms. It was interesting simply because Phil Spencer, who's the MS Studios corporate VP, said that basically Epic didn't have a firm plan what they wanted to do with it, which seems a little bit odd considering what a huge franchise it is, but it kind of has suffered a little bit from the law of diminishing returns. 1, 2, and 3, and then Gears of War Judgment perhaps didn't quite strike the same chord with fans. So Microsoft have bought it up and handing it over to Black Tusk Studios, formerly Microsoft Vancouver, and Rod Ferguson, who worked on the Gears of War franchise beforehand and is Irrational, obviously from Bioshock Infinite fame, will be having a hand in it as well. So, you know, the pedigree's there, and yeah, fingers crossed they can kind of reinvigorate it a little bit, give it a bit of a shot in the arm, because it definitely needs something.
I've never played any of them.
It's another reason to get people to buy, get them behind that paywall. The games with gold idea hasn't really transferred to the Xbox One yet. They really need to kind of bolster this idea that if you're going to play multiplayer games, you play it on their platform. So that's another reason to buy the live subscription. And, if you're not producing the TV series yet, you haven't got any other real content to show off, and you're not giving away free games, then you want to keep showing that you're kind of the place to be for multiplayer gaming.
Wasn't Gears of War, didn't it peak with 1, though, in terms of multiplayer? I mean, I know from the forums that it was a massive hit, the first one, in terms of the multiplayer, but everyone went off it after the second one.
I think that's almost true of so many different franchises. I mean, there was a graph kicking around showing the Call of Duty, the kind of peaks and troughs on that one, and it's basically just kind of slowly getting down to flatline. But in fact, if you look at it, the peaks are caused like a month afterwards when everyone's playing it, but the basic community tends to stay fairly level So I'd be surprised if that wasn't the same with Gears of War and the same with kind of Halo and that kind of thing.
So that wraps up the games. Rather short this week, but obviously the games podcast is coming up soon, where I'm sure you guys will go into this in more detail. So coming up next, movie news. So, Steve, it's been 6 minutes since you last spoke. So what's at the cinema?
This week we've got Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, which is the second attempt to reboot the Jack Ryan franchise, because obviously there was Some of All Fears, which was unbelievably 12 years ago when they tried to reboot it with Ben Affleck. And this time they're trying to reboot it with Chris Pine, who plays Captain Kirk in Star Trek, directed by Kenneth Branagh, who also plays the villain, and with Kevin Costner playing sort of Jack Ryan's mentor in the CIA, and Keira Knightley.
No tits.
I like Keira. I don't. Yes, she's flat-chested, but I thought
actually she was on Graham Norton on Friday night, and I've got to say, it's the first interview I've seen with her where you actually got a sense of her sense of humour, and she seemed to be really quite down to earth, to be honest.
Yeah, I think she's great, I think she's actually not a bad actress, to be perfectly honest. She's quite good in this. It's an interesting film because I know it was written originally not as a Jack Ryan movie, just as a sort of standard thriller, spy thriller, and then was converted into a Jack Ryan movie. And you do sort of feel a little bit when you're watching it that it could be anybody. You know, it's like a Born Light copy. You know, the fact that he's called Jack Ryan and the fact they made it the title of the film, it's like to really ram the point home. But it, you know, it could really have been anyone's story. It doesn't necessarily have to be Jack Ryan. And the fact that they're rebooting it a second time already, you know, suggests that maybe, obviously, the previous film, although I thought that Some of All Fears was really good, but clearly didn't have the box office potential to continue doing it. Previous to that, of course, you had, who else has played Jack Ryan? Alec Baldwin in Hunt for Red October, and then obviously Harrison Ford in Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. This one is... I tell you, the interesting thing is that because the villains in it are Russian, even though it's set now and it's all about sort of, you know, banking and trying to destabilize the economies of the economy of the US effectively, and therefore the world economy, because they're Russian villains, there's a sense of it's still got a kind of Cold War feel to it, because you know you're used to having Americans and Russian spies at it in Cold War thrillers from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but now with the change with the fall of the Iron Curtain and a change in sort of geo-global politics, it's less of an issue. But this one has a real old school spy feel to it, down to it, including people meeting on park benches and passing across documents in cinemas, that kind of stuff. So I actually really enjoyed it, even though, you know, it could have been about anyone. It didn't have to be about Jack Ryan. I thought that Kenneth Branagh did a really good job directing it. It's got some quite tense scenes in it, a couple of good action scenes. The cast is excellent. I had a fun hour and a half. It didn't tax me too much. It's not, you know, the best spy thrill I've ever seen, but certainly it was fun, which I think is the primary reason for watching it. Chris Pine was great as Jack Ryan. Costner was extremely good in it. Branagh was quite good playing the villain. And overall, I really enjoyed it.
But don't you think
solid it's, seven.
That's almost like the worst thing this film could be. Just good, solid fun. Because it always seemed like, you know, that they were supposed to be a little bit more serious. You know, they were good fun. They were, you know, spy movies. But certainly the Harrison Ford entries always had a slightly serious point to them. And they were a little bit more hard-nosed. And it just seems like, as soon as the name's in the title, it smacks of desperation, you know, like it could have been called Jack Ryan, Remember Me. And then they put in a young guy as the actor. And it just seems like this is going to go, you know, it's like Jack Reacher, you know, it's as soon as you have to put that name there, it's like saying, please love me. And I just think almost being middle of the road will be just what completely kills off the Jack Ryan franchise. Completely.
Do you know if Clancy was involved in this one at all?
Yeah, he was. It was the last thing he did before he popped his clogs.
Do you know if he? I don't know. This is takes it slightly off topic, but it bears repeating. If anyone has the Sum of All Fears as a Region 1 DVD, I don't know if it's on the Region 2. The DVD commentary with Tom Clancy is one of the. It rivals The Office for being just unbelievably awkward and yet magnificent viewing. I think it opens with, I'm Tom Clancy and I'm sitting next to the man that ruined my book. and it goes downhill from there.
I've got to say, if you look back at the previous Jack Ryan movies, they aren't that good. I mean, okay, The Hunt for Red October is basically a Sean Connery movie where Jack Ryan is a secondary character. Patriot Games is awful. You know, it's a classic Hollywood thing where it's a rogue element of the IRA. It's a rogue element because the good IRA and the bad IRA. No, f*** that. They're all a bunch of murderous bastards. You lot are funding them.
See you next week, Steve.
You can catch the AV Forums tour in Belfast next week.
They've got a Hollywood way they're trying to, like, you know, sidestep something. It's a serious and genuine issue, but in a way that only Hollywood can do it, by having Sean Bean running around as a rogue IRA gollop. Absolute bollocks. Clear and Present Danger.
So there wasn't a rogue IRA element.
Oh, there is. I'm not saying there isn't. There clearly is currently operating. But at the time, it was just them trying to not offend too many Irish people, basically. It was in some strange way, I think. Clear and Present Danger is genuinely good, I think, partly because John Milius co-wrote it. Some of All Fears, I really enjoy. I know it's different from the book. I know in the book it's Arabs and Israelis, isn't it, fighting each other out? Or someone trying to engineer a war between them. And in the film, it's someone trying to, a neo-Nazi trying to engineer a war between Russia and America. But I thought it was a really good film, if only because it had the balls to actually set the nuclear device off, which I thought was a brilliant plot point that, you know, I just did not see coming. And if you haven't seen the film yet, I apologize.
Thanks for that, Steve. Cheers.
But yeah, they haven't been that successful. They've tried multiple occasions and used four different actors and tried to reboot it twice now. Maybe they should stop flogging a dead horse.
Yeah, well, I mean, talking about flogging dead horses, Sylvester Stallone, Robert De Niro, Grudge Match.
You can just see this being pitched, can't you? It's Rocky Balboa against Jake LaMotta in a retirement home, because they're going to be like in their 60s now and retired. No one wants to see this. Because first of all, those two characters exist in completely different cinematic universes, don't they? One's like a serious biopic.
Well, different time zones as well, because LaMotta's, what, in his 90s?
Yeah. But they're just nothing to do with each other whatsoever. But obviously someone's thought, oh, what a brilliant idea. And having got past the what a brilliant idea bit, they actually have to come up with a film. And it's not very funny. De Niro, there's some shots of De Niro. You get to see some photographs of a young De Niro when he was really good. And you kind of just feel like crying for the guy. And then you used to be a proper serious actor. What the hell are you doing all this rubbish for? Does he need the money that badly? It's a strange film, you know. De Niro's character is fairly unsympathetic. Stallone doesn't have the range as an actor to carry the sort of the romantic elements of the plot. I mean, he basically is a relationship between, or actually a triangle, love triangle between him, De Niro, and Kim Basinger, who I've got to say, for 60 years old, yeah, I'd definitely still go there. She looked really good for her age. Yeah, it's not very funny, and it doesn't really work. And he kind of just felt a bit like a waste of time. But as I was handing my ticket over to the guy at the cinema, he said to me, yeah, the screen's ready for you. Yeah, he wasn't kidding. When I got in there, I was the only person in the cinema, literally the only person in there. Admittedly, it was 9 o'clock on a Sunday evening. Maybe that's not a big time to go to the movies, but I don't think it'll be doing particularly well at the box office, if that's anything to go by.
Blu-rays released this week. Rush, I think I'll pick that up. I know you like it, Ed.
Yep, I've got a copy on order. Along with a 4 terabyte NAS drive, that was my Amazon shopping last night. Just to keep that pre-selected. You may also like guessing.
Was this sober shopping or drunk shopping?
No, that was sober shopping last night. Drunk shopping is when I moved on to Discogs after that, and then bought some records. We'll leave it at that.
Sainsbury's winning, said.
That was we took 10 years of loose change to the coin machine, got 90 quid. But no, Rush is on order, definitely. I mean, I enjoyed it, and I'm hoping that it should be a nice, tidy, well-presented Blu-ray as well. Generally speaking, the bloke's name was completely Ron Howard. Films do generally port quite nicely over to the disc format of the time, so I have high hopes that this will be quite a good one.
Yeah, although I watched it on the plane, I really want to see it on disc, because I think the soundtrack's going to be fantastic. From what I heard on the plane, I think it will be superb.
The Hans Zimmer score is brilliant, yeah.
By the time this podcast goes up, Cass's review will be on the site. So.
Okay. The next one, Mortal Instruments. I know nothing about this. What is it?
You should know about it, Phil, because I spoke about it in one of the films I saw at the cinema back in the summer.
No, I always go either for a piss or I fall asleep at that point.
I have a sneaking suspicion it was one of the podcasts where we were either talking about the Phil Collins erotica or Theodore Rex.
It was because Lily Collins is the star of it and she's his daughter.
That's the one. And it kind of got lost in the excitement over Phil Collins.
Yeah, well, it's basically a tweeny romance, Twilight kind of thing. Very derivative. Don't bother.
Okay.
Unless you want to look at Lily Collins. I mean, she is gorgeous. I wouldn't mind begrudge you that, but otherwise, don't bother.
Another one I watched on the plane. I was slightly disappointed with it because I had pretty high hopes for it, and that was Sunshine on Leith. The musical, using the Proclaimer songs. Some of it was very good, some of it very funny. Some of the acting was a bit rubbish.
Sorry,
let's just say.
Did you say
some of the accents were a bit ropey?
Yeah, well, I was just going to say
Proclaimer songs.
Yeah, Proclaimer songs.
No,
yes,
the album plural. Sunshine on Leith.
Yeah, oh. Yeah. So, yeah, of course it's plural. Get away with you. Proclaimers are huge, massive. Yeah, the only thing was there was not an Edinburgh accent in there, which seeing as it was set in Leith in Edinburgh, didn't really work. And Jane Horrocks, I cannot stand that woman. And she spoiled the main song, which is Sunshine on Leith, which is a love song to Hibs, which is my team, and she murdered it. So I wasn't very happy with that. So I won't be picking this up on disc.
Yeah, I saw it too on the same flight as Phil. It was okay, but I don't really like the Proclaimers, to be honest. It's full of Scots people. In the
New shut up, you. Right, next one, The Call.
Yeah, The Call is Halle Berry. She plays a police officer who works in a call center, an emergency call center. And a girl gets kidnapped, manages to ring her up from a mobile phone, and she basically has to try and help her out. It's a thriller. It looked quite good in the trailers, but Kaz's review of this is also up now, and he says that basically it's great until the last 10 minutes when the film completely goes down the toilet and the plot goes to pieces and the whole thing gets ruined, which is a shame.
Okay, so that's another one for us to avoid. So we're not doing very well here. That's only one recommendation so far, which is Rush. This one's going to be popular. RoboCop Remastered. Chrissy's stuff's up on the site now, Steve.
Yeah, his reappraisal.
Well,
it
wouldn't be anything else given it, yeah, quite, Chris, yeah. You know.
He has an article about the film itself, which is very interesting if you're interested in RoboCop. It is quite long, but it's very interesting. Also, he reviews the Blu-ray, again, in some detail. This, I know that I've got the original release by MGM. It was a great transfer, in all honesty. This has been remastered now at 4K, and then the Blu-ray has been struck again. According to Chris, it looks vastly superior. It's never going to be perfect. It was a lowish budget movie. It was made like in 1987, so it's 27 years old now. It was never going to look perfect, but apparently they've done a really good job with the original camera negative, so it looks a lot better. It's got a host of new features on it, which look quite interesting. I actually watched the movie at the weekend, funnily enough. It's a classic. It is absolutely brilliant. It's a superb satire, ultra-violent. It's funny in places. It's got some great action, when they say they don't make films like they used to? Well, this is a good example. They just don't make them like they used to. I mean, the remake coming out, I think, next week, PG-13. Who gives a fuck about a PG-13 RoboCop? Just don't bother with the remake. Buy this. That's what I suggest.
I don't know. It's like that Big Trouble in Little China remake. My enduring memory of RoboCop was on a VHS, which had, I think, been stored underwater at some point, and it gave the transfer a unique quality that I just associate with it. And I don't know, having it all cleaned up and shiny, that doesn't sound right, but I'll look out for it. We'll see.
It's also the director's cut, which is a bit more violent than the original theatrical release.
Oh yes, because if there was one thing the cinematic release was lacking, it was violence, wasn't it? I just sat there going, yeah. God, it's really just so
yeah, it's just not violent enough. Come on, we want more. Yeah. But, of course, that was the appeal of the film at the time as well, and that's why people hold it in such high regard. Now, you're right, Steve. Did anybody ask for a remake? And if you're going to remake it, why the hell would you go for a PG-13 rating? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Even if you're going after a new generation, and we had this discussion with Carrie recently, the remake, and you made this point, why go for the new generation? Just remind them that this exists and it's on Blu-ray now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, well, there's been I feel a bit sorry for Paul Verhoeven because a lot of his films are being remade at the moment. They're doing they've just done RoboCop. There's talk about remaking Starship Troopers, which is only 1997, so does it really need to be remade? And that was a great film, although largely misunderstood film at the time. Total Recall's already been remade.
Badly.
You know, will anyone remake Showgirls? Probably not.
Oh, no, Basic Instinct. You couldn't remake that one. And talking about commentary tracks, That is an absolute masterpiece of a commentary on Basic Instinct. Basic Instinct, when he starts talking about our nipples, it's just comedy gold.
No, you listen to his commentary track on Starship Troopers as well. That's also really funny because he keeps pointing out when they're using a real actor and when it's a digital actor. But he's like, you know, he's going, real Johnny, digital Johnny, real bug, digital bug. Just whilst at the same time, Ed Neumeier is trying to like make some valid and interesting point about the satire inherent in the, you know, that in the film itself and how, you know, it's basically, you know, taking the mickey out of fascism. And it's lost because every time he says something interesting, all you can hear is Verhoeven screaming real bug and digital bug, which is, and it's not bug, but bug. He's mad as a hatter, actually, I think.
So anyway, that wraps up the Blu-rays that are released this week. There's two recommendations there. Go and buy Robocop and go and buy Rush. I think everybody will agree with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Can't argue.
The only person I don't know what he does during the day is Mark Botwright. Mark, what do you do during the day?
I don't let people behind the curtain.
So just for the sake of this conversation that we're about to have, are you at home during the day or do you go out to work during the day?
I am at home during the day.
Okay, so that's everybody on this podcast works from home, which means that we're home during the day. TV reviewers, so you gotta watch some TV. So this brings us onto the subject of daytime TV. And just who is daytime TV aimed at? And I was going through the listings today. Somebody mentioned this recently, and I thought, I'll have a look at this. And it's all aspirational programmes. So you got people selling antiques. You got people doing up properties and selling them one for a profit. And who is it that watches daytime TV?
People that want to escape the lives, I guess, isn't it? That's it.
Well, people who watch daytime TV are people who are sitting around, sitting at home, not working. But why they're watching programmes about antiques and
does
doing
anyone
up houses
actually watch
and cooking?
Them?
I generally have to, I've got to admit, I generally come downstairs of a morning and I'll turn it on just so it runs in the background.
Exactly. It's background noise. That's all it is.
Don't get me wrong. I would say at the moment, a particular highlight of actual daytime television, we're saying daytime television, who watches it? 11 a.m., BBC One, the sheriffs are coming. Genius.
What is that? Is that about bailiffs or something?
High court sheriffs, because
really?
Unlike bailiffs, these are the terminators of debt collection, because they cannot be stopped, bargained with or reasoned with. They'll just keep going and nick all of your stuff, and one of them actually looks like an enormous human thumb. I mean, as a program, it's got almost everything you could possibly ask for. There's schadenfreude in buckets, enormous heavily tattooed men. It's brilliant, fantastic. And it's
that's,
in HD.
That sandwiched in between Holmes Under the Hammer and Bargain Hunt, and so it's.
Get yourself
into debt and with you selling your house with an auction, and then
they combine the sheriffs are coming. The sheriffs take the stuff and then sell it on Bargain
Australia.
Well, isn't it between? It's between Holmes Under the Hammer and then. Helicopter Rescue Down Under or something like that, I believe, is what follows it. Not that I've actually watched that one, you know. But Sky gives you so much. There's endless tat possibilities for daytime across Sky. And the best one is obviously that they show standard evening programs, and they sort of hack them about for daytime viewing in the most unexpected and bizarre ways, and it just leads to them being literally reassembled by someone who either has a terrible hangover or didn't watch the original episode, and they can actually be quite good as a result of that. So
apart from us who actually work during the day while we're at home and maybe have the TV on in the background, again, who are they? You know, who are the viewers for this kind of stuff? I mean, let's face it, ITV is for Jeremy Kyle. Never watched it. Have no intention of watching it. I can see that being popular with a certain demographic who will be watching TV at that time of the day, having come in from a night of. But the good point is that a lot of this is aspirational TV, but do we want to watch aspirational TV? Does it just make us more depressed? I'm thinking of stuff like Escape to the Country, where, you know, these people have budgets of 500,000 or 1 million to spend on property or home and away. What's the name of that one? Where you can either buy a house at home or they buy a house abroad.
Oh, yeah. It's in Australia, usually.
Usually Australia.
I can't remember what it's called, but I know what
I know the one.
Oh, you're Place about. In the Sun. Or...
That's it, Place that's in the it. Sun, yeah. That's
the one. The thing is that half of them were filmed in like 2008, yeah. So you just wonder how many of those homes are repossessed now.
It always has valuation from 2010 or something like that on things
well,
like
that. Well, no, Mark makes a good point. It's, 2008 when people were paying silly money for property. That's another thing that homes under the hammer. These people that buy houses at auctions and have never been to see them. And you think, well, that's just a disaster in the making, although, that.
If you remember, I mean, obviously the one that always was a programme that was a victim of the time it was filmed in was the Sarah Beeny Property Ladder one, where it didn't matter how utterly inept the person doing up the house was, and the programme went out of their way to find people that were inept. The market was rising sufficiently fast that unless you literally burnt the house to the ground, you made money on it, except for the last series, which happened during the property crash. And it was like all of the producers' Christmases came at once, because there were people being absolutely financially destroyed in front of your eyes on daytime television. It wasn't magnificent for them, I suspect, but it made for compelling and thoroughly satisfying viewing. It's like, but
so are there any gems in there on daytime? I mean, I've got to admit that I don't watch an awful lot, but I will make time for Pointless.
A cheeky bit of Perfection too, one of
them. I Perfection don't mind the chase. Absolutely drives me up the wall, because I'm sorry, there's something disturbingly bleak about daytime quiz shows. At the end of someone's special subject or something, they say, right, and now the jackpot sits at £150.
And that's a rollover from the week before.
Yeah, exactly. You just want someone to turn around and say, my train fare to get here cost that. No,
but what you want to do is watch Challenge and watch, what was it?
Bullseye.
Bullseye with the prize money's £90.
Yeah.
And the one a speedboat and the living in Birmingham.
That's safe.
And a plastic bully.
That's
and a set of arrows.
And a one.
Yeah. And when they could have won it was always a car, wasn't it? Yeah. Or a speedboat. And when they did win,
if they did win, it was the speedboat, because they bought a job lot of 12 of them off a company that had gone into bankruptcy. The car was never won by anyone because it had to be given back to the dealer at the end of the show. But no, you'd see people, in like Coventry winning a speedboat. It's like, yes, because you're nice and handy for the ocean.
Yeah. Any other daytime TV gems that we should look out for?
It depends if you've got this. Obviously, it requires you to be a Sky customer. I don't know if it's on Virgin. It might be. But it must be said that Eurosport is doing the full warm-up for the Winter Olympics of insanely dangerous winter sports running pretty much throughout the day. And it's fabulous. I mean, there's bobsled, homoerotic bobsled.
Naked.
I don't know what its proper name is, but it features two men lying on top of each other on a tea tray. So my wife and I just christened it homoerotic bobsled.
Is that the luge?
Yeah, same basic. Shooting down an icy tunnel.
Luge or lube?
And also the great, I mean, the Eurosport television crews don't pull any punches. I mean, there's obviously cross-country skiing. It doesn't sound that exciting, but it's one of the most physically appalling sports you can do. It just drains energy like nothing else. And it'll get, people will cross the line, and then the Eurosport cameraman will just capture them in glorious 1080, throwing up lavishly all over the snow. And it's like, jump cut, guys. It's like, no, this is what it's like. And it's like, okay, fine, whatever. So it's great. And I will say that actually, I think for both genders and all sexual persuasions, Winter Olympians, full stop, are massively better looking than their summer counterparts. There are some beautiful, beautiful people doing winter sports.
I'm not even going to ask if that's male or female. That never mind.
I'm being all inclusive. I can appreciate beauty in all its forms. What can I say?
Well, I got to say, a guilty pleasure of mine is more for at 1:30 while I'm having my lunch for Time Team. And I don't know why. Well, I like
discovered another series of underground walls, have they?
Yeah.
Every day.
But
every
I don't know why I'm drawn to that programme, but I am. And I watch it religiously at 1:30 every day. And, I mean, it has some interest for me because obviously where I live is steeped in Roman archaeology and all the rest of it. I mean, the village I live in was a Roman village. The name of it is Longovisium. So I have an interest there. But I don't know, there's just something really relaxing about watching people digging holes in the ground. It's a guilty pleasure.
I used to watch it on a Sunday night when it went out first time.
So, do you know, the 4 p.m. air crash investigation, Phil?
Yes, but I've seen them all now, so they're all repeats. Oh, it's like Dave and watching Top Gear. I've seen them all now. So
air crashes, haven't they?
No. There's plenty more in the pipeline, according to the producers. But
I mean, obviously, at the time of recording this...
Are they causing them or something? No, they got planes. They got something to do a program on.
No, they fall out of the sky. Often. They only ever do series of six, so they generally have enough. And they're going further back in time now as well. Basically, there was one from the last series.
The Wright brothers crashing their plane.
No, I'm joking aside. There was one from the early 50s, and it was like Mad Men with plane crashes. It was brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, there was the one over the Grand Canyon.
That was the one.
Yeah, where they collided. I mean, the interesting thing about air crash investigation is that obviously they go to the far ends of a fart, basically, to find out what went wrong and then make the changes so that never happens again. And from that point of view, and the way that they conduct the investigations and stuff is really, really interesting. And you know it's based on fact as well. So, yeah, I love that programme. Another one I'm getting into at the minute is Fast and Loud on Discovery.
Oh, that's magnificent.
Absolutely brilliant.
Yes, the bloke with the beard is just magnificent. He's an engineering genius and the sort of thing that these quasi-reality TV shows were made for. He's just bonkers.
So yeah. The last one I saw, they bought a F40 Ferrari, a smashed up one, which had been in an accident for $400,000. Spent $400,000 on
$400,000.
Yeah, spent $400,000 getting it sorted and making changes to it. To bring it up to date, and I think they sold it for $1 million.
Sold it for $1 million flat, yeah. Or rather, the bloke who put most of the money up bought it out for $1 million. So I'd love to know what he does for a living because he doesn't look that sharp. But
yeah, he's also got a lot of money because he buys a lot of cars. But it is interesting. The guy who runs the garage was the guy who I don't know if was it the Cannonball Run or something similar to that they had one year. Which was a race across America, and he became famous because he had a Ferrari in it, and I think he won it, didn't he? Set a new record.
Set the new coast-to-coast time. Yeah. Although, ironically, that was beaten 8 weeks ago by a man in a 13-year-old Mercedes, which was dangerously full with auxiliary tanks of gasoline. Basically, if he'd been stopped at any stage, he'd have been thrown into prison forever. But no, the coast-to-coast US time was broken a couple of weeks ago. It was brilliant.
To refuel. Just kept going.
Yeah, they almost, I think it was done, there was either one fuel stop or no fuel stops, I can't remember. But they bought an old, literally it was a late 90s Mercedes, the S-Class Coupe, so the CLs, a V8, one of those. So not the fastest car going, but basically because it is enormous and has a huge amount of space in it, but all but the driver's seat and all the rest of it was basically turned into a travelling fuel tank. And then they drove it across the US in record time.
So if you had one cigarette, it'd have been in orbit.
It would have been bad, but they did it.
Let's go to Mark Boatwright just to wrap up. What's your favourite guilty pleasure daytime TV, Mark?
Probably, it seems to always be on Dave, but Storage Hunters.
that's one I've never gotten into.
What's that?
It's never poor into. Quality, faked reality, US reality TV, where people buy old storage lockers and, but they're so dense, it's spectacular because none of them have any kind of interest in antiques or anything like that or know about anything. What they do is they pick up a box and then one of them says, there's some weight to it. This will be worth money.
Yeah. So the thing is that the storage unit gets auctioned off at the start. So they're not allowed to look in. They're allowed to look in, but they're not allowed to go into the storage unit. And then they got a bid on it. And then the winner of that storage unit then gets to go in and see what's in there. And it could be old newspapers or it could be a safe with gold and diamonds and all the rest of it. I mean, it's... But a lot of it is faked. A lot of it's
faked, all of it's fake.
Yeah, I mean, the original plan, there's actually interesting story of this. The original plan was that, as well as showing people bidding for it and winning the lots, they'd interview with the people that had to give, had that originally owned the lot and had lost it. But the stories of the people that lost it were so uniformly depressing and tragic that it just couldn't be made into television because it was just awful in every single way. And yeah, one of the characters is in some of the early seasons. He then left the show, and yeah, he basically lifted the lid on how it had as much to do with reality as it did, you know, Gears of War. It was completely
Particularly, a case in point today, I mean, the valuations that they give, like, you know, no matter what it is, no matter how much they've bought the locker for, they'll usually end up saying, yeah, no, I can get $1,000 for this teapot or something. Today, I was watching one, they had an old NES in there and an Atari 2600, and they thought they'd get over $2,000 for them. You know?
I mean, to be fair, it's not quite as bad as... I haven't watched a single episode of this, I stress, but there's Amish Mafia on, I can't remember which channel.
That's Discovery as well.
Basically, there was a strap line at the bottom of it. Some scenes had been reenacted television. And they were forced, and then somebody asked what percentage of the show had been reenacted for television purposes, and Discovery were forced to concede the figure was 100%.
Well, that's the same as that other one that just started a couple of weeks ago, and I watched the first pilot and I won't be going back to it. It's called Airplane Repo, and
yeah,
it's basically about the bailiffs that go after people who have... £2 and 3 million jet, Lear jets and that kind of thing, and they've got to get them back for the bank. And you're watching that and you're thinking, this is just so put on. And then it says at the end, a lot of this is dramatisation to protect identities and all the rest of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's no Lizard Lick Towing, is it?
No. Or Big Rig Bounty Hunters.
But I think the best one of that bunch or that type of programme is Pawn Stars. Absolutely love that. I think it's brilliant.
Yes.
And it's into, I think it's 26th season.
But you can learn something about in Pawn Stars. I would say that occasionally they will have something on the show about which I learn something. And that, you know, by the incredibly low standards of the History Channel in 2014, that's not a bad thing. You know, it's notable that the History Channel doesn't have any historical programming.
Well, the best one was just before Christmas, where they did that series about the First World War, and then they changed it into War of the Worlds, so it was actually an alien invasion. It was like, what the f***?
Yeah, children watching that are going to have some funny ideas about the First World War, it must be said. Meh.
So, to wrap up, Ed, what's your guilty pleasure?
Oh, there's so many. I'm annoyed. I mean, it's been ages. They used to have Airwolf on D-Max at 10 o'clock in the morning, and there was no finer way to start the day than an episode of Airwolf. But it is probably, at the moment, it's ridiculous winter sports on Eurosport and or... I suppose the other thing I'm rewatching, and I hate myself for doing it, 10 o'clock in the morning on Alibi HD, Rizzoli and Isles. And I don't know why I like that program, but I do. I'm just going to stand on that and go with it.
And of course,
as mentioned ages ago, The Sheriffs are coming. That's on BBC One. And if you haven't watched it, do so. You're in for a treat. Magnificent. Schadenfreude are embodied.
Hodge?
Countdown. Just a boring one. I like a bit of that.
It wasn't a patch on
15
to 1.
No, 15 to 1. I also like quiz shows. I like The Chase. Is that still daytime? Nothing. I don't really get to watch a lot during the day because I've got kids. So if they're home, then they'll have their crap on.
Peppa Pig.
No, I do like Peppa Pig. And Ben and Holly. No, that's even better. That's slightly more grown up.
The Explorer?
No, that's crap.
Mr. Maker?
Mr. Maker, no. He's a tit.
Justin's House? Yeah.
No, again, see Mr. Baker. What kids shows are good?
Modern Scooby-Doo?
No, f*** off.
Oh, no.
That's a bit weird now, actually, because they're all in relationships.
No. No, I can't do that.
Yeah, what's
a relationship with a dog? And
it's all gone a little bit Dawson's Creek in places.
Oh, no, they haven't, have they?
Has Velma come out as a lesbian, at least?
No, no, she was interested in Shaggy in the last episode. I swear to God.
All like he's been interested in Scooby-Doo.
What the fuck? Lavender marriage in the offing there, eh?
What's this? What am I missing here?
No. The new Scooby-Doo.
Oh, right.
She's got a catchy little theme tune as well.
Did the new Scooby-Doo still infer that Shaggy was a drug addict and that's why he used to eat all those sandwiches?
He had the munchies.
It was clearly
basically.
Well, I think the weirdest one from, you know, my childhood was Mr. Ben. What the fuck was that about?
I love Mr. Ben.
Nah, the clangers. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Magic Roundabout was pretty good.
What was that, Steve?
Magic Roundabout.
Grossly overrated.
I didn't get that one either. But Mr. Ben, it was just weird.
What was it? Every week, Mr. Ben goes to dress up and finds himself in a new adventure. They wrote it, the TV synopsis was done in such a way that made it sound especially dodgy.
It was only 13 episodes, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you think there was thousands. As a kid, I thought there was thousands of these. But no, I got to find out there was only 13.
Yeah, it was a bit
I must have watched about 10 or 15 times each of.
A bit like Fawlty Towers, yeah. Isn't it? That leaves us with Withers.
It's a toss-up between Father Brown Investigates, which I quite like.
Rosemary and Thyme.
Escape to the Country is not too bad because often they're like moving to somewhere near me, which is always quite cool. But I've watched a lot of Bargain Hunter recently because I developed a bit of an obsession with Catherine Southern for some strange reason.
You knock one off over Bargain Hunter.
Yeah.
Is that how you entertained yourself in that empty auditorium?
So that's why I kind of get hold of you. What time is that on? Is that on at lunchtime? Is that why I kind of get hold of you on Skype because you're knocking one off?
Was it 12 till 12:30? No, it's just before the news. It's the program before the news at 1 o'clock. So for that period, when I say I'm having lunch, I'm having something, but it's not necessarily food based.
Oh God!
You said you liked Doctors as well earlier.
Oh yeah, Doctors is good. Not so much. I liked it, but good.
And on that bombshell.
Okay, so that just shows you how sad the AV Forums team are. Working from home, watching daytime TV, there are our recommendations if you are in the same situation. If you're taking a sickie, do not watch daytime TV because it'll just make you depressed. It'll make you worse. Don't do it.
We're all professionals, so we know what we're doing.
Yeah, we're professionals. We know what we're doing. Anyway, that's the end of the podcast for this week. I think we've talked enough crap once again. So join us again next Wednesday. Before then, I need to thank Steve Withers.
Just like that. He was gone.
Mark Botwright.
You have a sweet night, ladies.
Mark Hodgkinson.
I tell you, this guy is protected from up on high by the Prince of Darkness.
And Ed Selly.
One cannot be betrayed if one has no people.
Don't forget you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Bookmark avforums.com for the latest reviews, news and video. Plus, why not leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton. Thanks for listening. And like I said, we'll see you again next Wednesday.